All right, everybody, welcome to episode 714 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
I'm Manny.
This is a Spotlight Friday episode, and today Manny and I are going to be talking about three recent comics, Justice League Annual number one, as we continue to look at the Scott Snyder, James Tynion run on Justice League and how closely it ties into the DC Universe. We're also going to talk about a recent boom comic, WWE Forever number one. And then we're stretching back a little further to talk about a comic that Manny and I both have been wanting to talk about on the show for quite a while. It's Oblivion Song number one from Robert Kirkman. But first, a reminder, this episode of The Comic Source is brought to you by Aftershock Comics, the independent comics and graphic novel publisher, sending shockwaves throughout your local comic shop with groundbreaking series like A Walk Through Hell by Garth Ennis and Goran Suzuka, which has issue 8 hitting stands really soon. We also have Animosity by Marguerite Bennett and Raphael De La Torre, Dark Arc from Cullen Bunn and Juan Doe, and new must-read series like Oberon by Ryan Parrott and Miloš Slavkovic, Stronghold from Phil Hester and Ryan Kelly, and coming soon, Dark Red, a tale of vampirism in the heart of America from Tim Seeley and Corin Howe. So be sure to check out all those titles and more by going to aftershockcomics.com. And remember that their slogan this year is to read dangerously. Aftershock is challenging you to take a walk on the wild side. Try something different. Try something edgy. A lot of the Aftershock creators are names you know from publishers like Marvel and DC and Image, but this is a chance for them to tell stories that maybe don't fit in at one of the big two. Maybe it's a creator-owned title, something they've been looking to do for a long time. And I think that's really key when it comes to Aftershock books. The fact that these are creator-owned titles with full editorial support, you get a mix that you can't get anywhere else. You know, a lot of creators take their creator-owned work over to Image, which is great. Image is a great publisher. They're great at what they do. But you don't get the same sort of editorial support that you get in other places. It is sort of up to you to do it all as a creator. You've got to market the book. You've got to create the book. You've got to handle the printing and the publishing, the shipping, all that. And so it's a lot. And some of these creators, you know, they just want to write. They just want to create the stories that we get to read. So you get the passion of a creator-owned project, but also kind of the structure and support system of a full editorial staff. And what comes out the other side are incredible books from Aftershock that are really edgy and show the passion of the creators. So we're big supporters, obviously, and we love Aftershock. Do yourself a favor. As I said, go to aftershockcomics.com, check out their site. They have a diverse lineup, something for everybody, and more good stuff on the way. All right, on to the books that we're going to talk about today. Let's start with Justice League number one. I feel like, or Justice League Annual number one, I should say. I feel like this issue kind of wraps up the first chapter of Scott Snyder's big plan for Justice League. As I mentioned earlier, Justice League has really become a huge part of the DNA of the DC Universe currently. And what happens here is not good, to put it lightly. And it really sets up everything in the DC Universe going forward. So this issue was written by Scott Snyder and James Tynion. We have Tynion with the script, Daniel Sampier handling pencils, Juan Alberon on inks, Adriana Lucas on colors, and Tom Napolitano on letters. And let me just talk about the art, first of all. So Daniel Sampier, I'm familiar with his work. He's done some DC work over the last few years. I actually got a sketch from him at San Diego Comic-Con a couple of years ago. I'm racking my brain right now to try to remember what it is, and I can't remember. I'll have to pull out my sketchbook. But the pencils are really, really well done. And one thing I love about what Daniel's done here is he has really clean line work, but I really love his layouts. This is a very busy book in terms of how many creators or how many characters rather are on the panels. And he lets everybody shine. I love the layouts. It's really in my mind where the strength of his art lies, the way he lays panels out so that you get a good cross-section of a lot of different characters that are in it. Cause again, I can only imagine that this took him a long time to draw. because there are a lot of characters and there's a lot going on, a lot of action, a lot of big explosions in space, which brings me to my my next comment about the art, which is, okay, I'm calling it right now, Manny. Adriana Lucas is my colorist of the year for 2019. That guy's been killing it on everything he does. You know, I've always loved his work on Thief of Thieves over at Skybound, Robert Kirkman's property. But that's, you know, it's a book about a master thief, and you don't really get a chance to really maybe let your color skills shine in a book like that. But a book like this, a book like Freedom Fighters, which is another book that he's working on, man, he's just really killing it. I think he's also doing Hardcore right now over at Image, so he's doing a great job on that. So the guy has just been blowing me away. And the color work in this book really takes that Daniel Sampier artwork to another level. Whenever the villains are on the page, we get a lot of blues and purples and greens. You know, Brainiac makes his triumphant return, if you will. And the way he colors the source wall, the explosions, Starman's power, Hawk Girl's wings glowing. Yeah, it's absolutely stunning color work. And right from the start, when you see that first title page and we see the Justice League trying to hold the source wall together with what looks like the markings that you would see on a mother box, like right from there, I was like, wow, this is really going to be something special. And throughout the entire book, he just really has colors that leap off the page. It's this two-dimensional art, and he does such a great job of making it look like it's glowing. Both the little nodules on Brainiac 5's head, or when we see Starman later in the issue, basically powering up everybody. That's done really well also, as he's kind of glowing with this pinkish energy. And then when we see the source wall sort of explode, you know, it was bad enough when the source wall was broken and leaking, and then it kind of gets literally blown up in the issue, and that's an incredible splash page as well. So the art in this issue is top-notch, and as much as I feel like Marvel has improved over the past year or so, with their stories, they're still putting out way too many books and way too many variants and such. But one thing they haven't slowed down on is putting out like these landmark issues with these artists that I've never heard of. Like, they really need to stop doing that. They have some good artists over there, and I can never understand when it's some kind of a landmark issue and that there's just some artist on there who I've never heard of. And I keep my ear to the ground. Granted, I don't know every artist, but I keep my ear to the ground, and I can never understand when they're putting out this important issue, this key issue, and it has art that is just subpar. It makes me crazy when they do that. So that's not DC, and I don't know if it's because DC pays more, that they have the better artists these days or what, but I love that they make sure that on issues that are important like this, as important as this annual is, that they have really good art on the book. So that was my initial impression as I read it. The story's wild and crazy, but the art really puts it over the top and elevates the story. If you read DC Comics, you know, beyond just like maybe you only read Batman and you just stay in that Batman universe, that's fine. But if you want overall like what's going on in the DC universe, you should be reading Justice League and you should be reading Doomsday Clock. And this Justice League annual really sets up the next year of Justice League stories, I feel. So yeah, what were your initial impressions of this issue?
Just a massive kind of climatic issue that this is. Like you were saying, just based on, you know, the first few panels, you know, you see the entire league together with Starman. You see the Giants. You see the wall. Just so much is going on, and then you know what's at stake already, and exactly what they're going to try to go do. And so, you know, it's kind of one of those where you just gotta sit back and enjoy it, because it's what I call a payoff issue. Just you've gone through been a guard, you've gone through so much. You went through the Aquaman arc. I mean, just so much going on. This even goes back to, of course, the no justice, and finally you kind of see it all coming together, and it's just, just like you're saying, just so beautifully illustrated, and then as well as colored. I mean, you could just see the immense kind of importance of it all. And just, I mean, just when you think it's all coming together, you know, it's Brainiac, and just wham, just flips everything on its lid, and it was a great, great issue. And I mean, if this is, you know, just the beginning of what Zack Snyder has planned for the rest of his
Scott
for the rest of his, sorry,
Scott, you said Zack Snyder. What? You said Zack Snyder.
Oh, sorry. Scott Snyder has planned for the rest of his story for Justice League. I mean, it's something that we're going to have to hang on for a while, because it's so good.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I don't know that this is a drawback at all. I don't think that at all. But what's funny is actually the last time Manny was on to talk about a Justice League book was Justice League 15. And that was also Scott Snyder and James Tynan plotting with James doing the scripting. And we talked about it, how it was a little bit wordy. And now here in here we are with Justice League Annual 1. And again, it's the kind of the same creative lineup, right? We have, in terms of writers, we have Scott and James collaborating together on the overall story, but we have James scripting. And because of I mean, it's not indicative of James's writing style normally to be so wordy, but this does. There, it's just that this story is so big, like Manny said. There's so much that needs to happen, so much that is important to the story, so much that needs to be kind of explained, that it does tend to be a little bit wordy. And this is one of those stories too where it's like the heroes were so close to victory. And it was just like, no, like when it happens, when the climax of the issue happens, you're just like, no, they were so close to fixing the source wall, to fixing what they broke. But then, and I don't blame them at all, but the source wall, as I said, explodes at the end of the issue. And now they're worse off than they were before. And it's just like, oh man, they were so close. They were so close to things being, to saving the day and things being back to normal. And instead, things are worse than ever. So let me give a real quick synopsis of the issue, and then we'll talk a little bit more about it. So the heroes, the Justice League, and probably what we'd say would be the extended Justice League, is headed out to the Source Wall to try to fix it, basically. We've got the Trinity of Batman, Wonder Woman, Superman, Flash is there, John Stewart, Green Lantern, Kyle Rayner, Green Lantern, Starman, Mira, Hawkgirl, Martian Manhunter, Miss Martian, and yeah, they're there to fix the hole in the source wall that they caused. And this is all due to Will Payton, Starman, who we know his power actually is derived from the totality. So he has a plan, and basically what they do is the Omega Titans that we first saw in No Justice, they're going to use them to plug the hole in the source wall. So they pull them from various places and with the help of the New Gods and the Guardians of the Universe. So they basically plug the holes in the source wall, as I said, with these Titans. And once they get the last Titan in place, the breach will be sealed and everything will be great. Except Luthor, Brainiac, and the rest of the Legion of Doom don't want that to happen. They have they don't have complete contact and communication with Perpetua yet. But they're on their way to that. And basically, when they arrive, they disrupt the plan that Starman had. And when that happens, the New Gods disappear. And when the New Gods disappear, it causes an issue with one of the Omega Titans that was supposed to help heal this breach, and there's sort of like a feedback loop, and the wall explodes. And so now it's like whatever was on the other side of the source wall isn't leaking through anymore. Now it's just gone. Like the source wall's gone, and everything that was out there is back. And not only did Perpetua remove the new gods, they've been, we don't know where. We don't know if she transported them anywhere or they destroyed them, whatever. Not only were the new gods that were there at the source wall gone, but New Genesis is gone. Apocalypse is gone. There was just this flash of light. And all of a sudden, it's like they don't exist anymore. So not 100% sure. I don't remember. It's been a little bit since I've read this. I don't remember if we... Did they tell us why that happened, Manny? Do you remember? I know it had to do with Perpetua waking up, but I don't remember if they told us exactly why she removed the new gods.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think they told us. But it was clearly her doing, and it's kind of like a domino effect, right? They remove the new gods. The new gods are no longer in control of being able to sort of keep their Omega Titan in check. And when their Omega Titan basically overloads and explodes, it takes the other Omega Titans and the Source Wall with it. New Genesis is gone. Apocalypse is gone. Throughout the DC Universe, near New Genesis, in the Ghost Sector, on Earth, in Heaven, the House of Heroes in the Multiverse, they all feel it. They all sense the destruction of the Source Wall. And what the villains do is they basically harness the energy from the destruction of the Source Wall, and they use it to help Perpetua reform herself. And we have not yet seen the ramifications of that as well. So the heroes, as I said, they were so close to fixing the Source Wall. And now instead of fixing it, the Source Wall has been destroyed. Perpetua has returned to a physical form. She's no longer trapped inside that piece of the totality that we saw fall to Earth. And yeah, like I said, this really sets up the entire Justice League story going forward for this next year. And it feels big, and it feels of consequence, and it's really cool. This was one of those great issues where, like Manny said, it really gave you some payoff for reading Justice League like all this time. And it wasn't payoff in terms of, okay, we got the end of the story, but it was a big chunk of the story that kind of shows us where the story's going to go. Like, you could think of it as a big marker for the story going forward. So great issue. And yeah, I can't wait to see what the next big part of the story is going to be like. What were your thoughts, Manny, on the issue, the art, everything?
You know, big shout out to Hawkgirl, who was going to sacrifice everything to fix the universe. You know, she was ready to be part of that wall. And unfortunately, thanks to Brainiac, that didn't come too. But I just thought, you know, you just put, I'm not the biggest Hawk, I guess you just say people fan, just Hawkman or Hawkgirl in general. But it was very impressive to see her in that light, to just ready to just give up everything to make sure that the universe stays put. And then, I mean, just as you go through the issue, you see all of the entities involved. You have the Green Lantern Corps, the New God, the Justice League, Starman. I mean, just everyone is invited to the party to make sure that this happens and it works, and that Starman's plan is gonna hold the universe together. And then, of course, you know, just in the nick of time, doesn't happen just because Brainiac shows up along with the rest of the Legion of Doom and the baby, and so it doesn't happen. And it's just by the end of the issue, you understand just the severity of the the problem with a couple of the other characters that just all of a sudden just feel that something's wrong. I mean, you had Darkseid, you had even some of the other multiverse Justice League showing up, and the Phantom Stranger also. I mean, just everywhere, just feeling the effects of what had just happened. And so, and then the Justice League and everyone else retreating to their respective places to get ready for what's to come, because, you know, it's only going to get worse from here, is something that even the Legion of Doom realizes as well. So it's a really, really, like you said, like a good marker for the story, and because it's, you know, now we can move on to the next chapter, which is where you can imagine the amount of things that are going to transpire in the next issues of Justice League. It's kind of crazy. Something that like I can really see how much thought, how much effort was put. Not to say that other books don't have a lot of thought or effort, but just when Scott Snyder said it was his gift to you know, longtime readers, yeah, this is definitely the type of story that you classify that as.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And it's one of these things where the story, that first issue just impressed me so much. The first issue of Justice League, it felt like this was something that was so special and momentous. And then issue two, it wasn't a disappointment or a step down, but it just it didn't feel as big. And then it seems like ever since then, it started building back up to where this issue, this annual one, feels just as big as the initial story, that initial story in issue one. So I can't wait to see where it goes from here. And again, I just love how much this ties in and feels so connected to the rest of the DC universe. And like I said, the art, holy moly, this issue, like every single page is just stunningly good. And I keep going back to the colors by Adriana Lucas. Every page is just like, even when it's light on skin, like you look at the very last panel where Lex Luthor is looking at Perpetua in this like stasis tube, and she's kind of glowing green, and that greenish color is reflected on Luthor's face. It's just, it's done so, so well. So I know I sound like a broken record lately about Adriana Lucas, but man, he is doing just an incredible job, and I love it. He's just unreal. So I just talk about colors a bit more. I keep thinking every year I do this, I'm like, okay, this is going to be the year where I give Jordi Belair my best colorist award, and then somebody always comes in and swoops it from her. So I don't know. I have 11 months, 10 months to make up my mind, but yeah, Adriana Lucas, man, it's killing it. I don't know how I don't give it to him. But then again, I say that every year about Jordi Belair. So anyway, let's move on. WWE Forever number 1 from Boom Studios. This is a like giant size 40 page issue with a ton of stories in it. We have a Show of Heart, written by Michael Kingston, with art by Mikel Malipola, M-U-L-I-P-O-L-A, Malipola. Apologies for mispronouncing that, I'm sure. It's colored by Matthias Laborde, lettered by Jim Campbell. We have King of the Bling, written by Lan Pitts, illustrated by Carlos Magno, colored by Doug Garbark, also lettered by Jim Campbell. The Royal Treatment, written and illustrated by Derek Fridolfs, colored by Fred C. Striesing, also lettered by Jim Campbell. We have Internal Audit, written by Arun Singh, illustrated by Kendall Good, lettered by Jim Campbell. And then finally, The Brain versus the Bulldog, written and illustrated by Brett Schoonover, colored by Doug Garbark, and lettered by Jim Campbell. So it's an anthology. It's a throwback to the old school days of WWE, which actually back then it was when it was called the WWF, World Wrestling Federation. And this technically this is a little after I started paying attention or stopped paying attention. I think, like, for me, it was right around like 1987, 1988, where that was like the 6 month period where I actually paid attention to wrestling. Haven't paid any attention before or since. It was a very short period of time when WWF kind of expanded into pop culture and they had a Saturday morning cartoon and people started paying a little bit more attention to them. And it's been a huge industry ever since. It's just not, I don't know. I didn't stay interested for whatever reason. But these are stories set back in that time about a lot of these wrestlers that are legends. And I actually knew some of these names. But Manny's a much bigger wrestling fan than I am. So I'm gonna let him take a lead on talking about this. I will say this was enjoyable for a point of nostalgia, because I did recognize some people like Junkyard Dog and Bret the Hitman Hart, Ted DiBiase, the Million Dollar Man, Razor Ramon, Bobby the Brain Heenan, right? Is that his name?
Yeah.
Is that guy still alive?
I don't know. I'd have to look that up.
And then and obviously the Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart, I recognized as well. One guy I didn't recognize was this IRS guy. I don't remember him like at all. But anyway, it was a fun ride down memory lane. It's not my cup of tea, honestly. I think it's great that these wrestling comics do exist, because there are a lot of fans, and I love that there's crossover. So if we look at the cover, we see Andre the Giant, we see Rowdy Roddy Piper, we see Junkyard Dog, and then who's the guy with the long hair?
Oh, that's the British Bulldog.
Really?
Wait, are you talking about? Wait, what are you talking about?
On the cover, the guy with the.
Oh, the cover?
Yeah.
My bad.
The guy in the red robe with the silk.
The cover. No, come on, man. That's the biggest feature there is Andre the Giant.
Yeah.
Roddy. Rod Piper, yeah. Ric Flair, and Junkyard Dog.
Yeah, that's who it is. Ric Flair. That's who. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Out of all the people on that cover, you don't recognize the styling, profiling, limousine riding, jet. No?
See, Ric Flair, when I watched WWF, he wasn't like super big at that time for whatever reason. It was all about Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant, Jake the Snake. I remember watching on a Saturday morning, I don't even remember what it was called, the show, the WWF show. But I remember seeing the debut, the World Wrestling Federation debut of Randy the Macho Man Savage. When he came out with Elizabeth, right? That was her name,
right?
And was he managed by Jimmy Mouth of the South?
Hart? I believe so.
Yeah. So yeah, I remember seeing that the very first time the Macho Man wrestled. So
I'm very, very disappointed that you couldn't name. I mean, out of everyone, Ric Flair. That's,
yeah, he's the one that I don't. Yeah, I don't know why I didn't know Ric Flair. He just wasn't. Like, I knew so many of the guys, like Captain Lou Albano and, you know, the Iron Sheik. And I can never remember the Iron Sheik's partner's name, the Russian guy.
I don't remember his name either.
But yeah, I mean, I knew a lot of these guys. But yeah, Ric Flair, he was just never one that I paid that much attention to.
Wow.
But like Jimmy Superfly Snuka. And yeah, I remember a lot of these guys. But yeah, Ric Flair, I don't know. He was never really on my radar. But anyway, these were some fun stories, like I said, a trip down memory lane, but I don't think I'll be picking up wrestling comics anytime soon. But do you read like the WWE comics? I mean,
I've been meaning to catch up on them. It has not ever been on top of my list per se. But especially because of how far behind I am now, I think they're like issues 30 something. I picked up a couple of variant covers of here and there, because I'm big fans of like Sasha Banks. I like the New Day cover that they had one time, and then they have like the title covers. I mean, so they're pretty good, but I've been wanting to go all the way back to from issue one and take a look at the books. So not yet, but I will tell you that I almost religiously watch Raw on Mondays, SmackDown on Tuesdays, NXT on Wednesdays. So there you go. and then with our my buddy Cody and I, we have the WWE Network, So we go back and check out classic matches all the time, just to kind of refresh, you know, some of those classic moments. And a lot of times it's some of these great characters, just because the quality sometimes of the writing isn't there nowadays as it was back then.
Yeah, and there's a lot, I feel, and maybe this is just my, you know, lack of knowledge. I feel like there's a lot more like wrestling organizations now than there used to be. Like it used to just be like, what it was like whatever one was on the USA Network. It was like,
Actually you're right and wrong about that, because for the last, I don't know how many years, ever since the fall of ECW, it's really been WWE, as the, you know, the bread and butter, the mainstream wrestling show. And then from there, there was a couple of other companies that tried to get going. Ring of Honor is one of them. There was TNA Wrestling, and TNA Wrestling tried really hard, and they just had really, really bad ownership. And they actually came back now. They're doing okay, getting a little bit more traction. Same thing with Ring of Honor. And then also there's on Netflix, there's Lucha Underground, which is a little bit more of like a traditional Mexican style wrestling. And then there's the ever so popular New Japan Wrestling, which is where a lot of guys that WWE ignored took off to over there, and they've produced some of the biggest stars in the world. And actually WWE just screwed up bad with Cody Rhodes, the son of Dusty Rhodes, and now him, his wife, and a couple of his buddies who wrestled New Japan are in the mix of starting their own brand called AEW, which is actually backed by the family that owns the Jacksonville Jaguars. So they have a ton of money. They have a ton of hype right now, especially because they signed probably one of the top five wrestlers in the world right now, Kenny Omega. And ever since they made their announcement a couple of months ago, WWE, they don't want to admit it, but they've been a little nervous, because all of a sudden it's quite a few people who are like, well, if you're not going to pay attention to my character, I'm out. They're doing everything they can to lock in talent for the next 5 years.
Yeah, I find it all kind of interesting, because like I said, back in the day there was WWF, which then eventually became WWE because the World Wildlife Federation sued them and didn't want them there. Which was crazy, because they used WWF for like 10 years, and then all of a sudden it was like, no, you can't use it anymore. It was weird. But and then the other one was, I want to say...
WCW.
Was it WCW? Was that the one that Sting, yeah. Sting was a member of?
Yeah, Sting, Nash. Well, Nash was both. Yeah. Who else came out? Sting. A lot of those guys were both close sides, but yeah. Sting was one of their main guys.
Those were the two big ones back in the day that I knew about, but I didn't really
pay attention. Oh, Diamond Dallas Page, that's another big guy from there.
But yeah, so the thing is, like, I had no idea what to expect when I read this, and it was interesting in as much as it feels like you're getting the same sort of storylines that you kind of get in the wrestling TV shows. Because I didn't know what to expect at all. But the one thing I wonder about, that, you know, this was kind of an anthology with a bunch of different stories with characters. So, and maybe you don't know this because you haven't been reading them, even though you've been wanting to check them out. Like in the regular narrative of you know, wrestling, you know, watching them from, and I don't know this at all, because there's different, like you said, there's Monday Night Raw, and then there's other like shows. So does a storyline from Monday Night Raw, does that cross over into like another show, or is that storyline just always show up on Monday Night Raw?
Well, what they try to keep them separate because they're kind of two different traveling shows, so they're not necessarily near each other.
Okay.
But there's some storylines that do cross over. They just introduced, like, for example, the tag team women's champions. And because there's not enough tag teams for both, they have them going from show to show. And then also probably one of their biggest matches ever, which is going to end up being, let's be honest, it's going to be a triple threat between Becky Lynch, Charlotte Flair, and Ronda Rousey. Charlotte's from SmackDown, but the Ronda's from Raw, and because the angle is going to end up at WrestleMania, it bounces from show to show. But most of the time, most of the angles stay on their own shows.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. So the next question would be: so when you're reading the, well, I have a couple questions actually, and this is turning into not a review of WWE forever, but just kind of a wrestling comics and wrestling general talk. But that's fine. Which I have talked to, I know his first name's Mike, and he puts out wrestling comics, under his own brand. I'm going to have to look it up. He's been on the show a couple times. He does a lot of shows. He's at San Diego every year, and, he has like Sting has been at his table to sign. And who's the other, and I guess it was Ric Flair, has been at his table. Was he on at TNT for a while too?
Ric Flair on TNA?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a really tough time for him because he should never have done that. And there's actually a 30 for 30, I think it's a 30 for 30 on Ric Flair. That's really good. You should probably watch it and you kind of get a sense of what happened to him. I mean, this guy lived, a lot of these characters have it's called kayfabe, which is their character, and they obviously when they're on screen they portray their character and they don't break it, unless especially on like social media or during shows or things like that. But backstage it's different, obviously, because it's entertainment. It's not real. It's scripted. No, Ric Flair lived that life.
Yeah. Anyway, so he's been there at this guy's booth to sign. He's had some other really big guys as well. His name's Mike Kingston, and the name of his company is Headlocked. It's Headlocked Comics, and he tells they tell a lot of different kind of wrestling stories in comic format. So anyway, back to my other question. First of all, being that there are so many organizations, are there other wrestling comics besides just the WWE license that Boom has? I wonder about that. And would you be interested in reading any of those? And also, so like you mentioned, the regular series or whatever is up to like issue 30. Are each of the issues self-contained, or is it like a, you know, regular comic where it's a storyline that plays out over like multiple arcs? And do they collect them in trade? I don't know. I haven't ever paid enough attention. I don't think I've ever seen a wrestling comics collected in trade.
You know what? That's a good question, because I've never heard of it being collected in trade. But I'm quickly while you're talking about it, just kind of browsing the first few issues. I'm going to go back and take a look at them a little bit more in depth. But it looks like it is a continuous story, and wouldn't be surprised if these are just some of the failed storylines that didn't make it to television.
Yeah. The other thing, real quickly, I'll mention about Headlock Comics. Jerry the King Lawler is also, he's written comics for Headlock.
Comics.
And I don't know if he's co-creator of Headlock Comics with Michael Kingston, or if he's just a contributor. But I do remember when I interviewed Mike, he did mention Jerry several times, which, again, not being a big wrestling guy, I didn't know, like, is that a really big guy, or is he like a legend? And apparently he is. Apparently he's a really big guy in wrestling history. So anyway, why don't we get back to talking about this WWE Forever issue? Because we haven't gotten your impression, Manny. What do you think of it overall?
I thought that it started off with a really, really strong story. The first one by Michael Kingston, as you talked about, which was a show of heart. And I kind of really like the approach to it. It starts with that young Bret the Hitman Hart before his debut. And you have Jimmy Hart just hyping him up. And the cool thing about him hyping him up is that Well, this all happened, obviously, in the past. So he's hyping him up with the highlights of his career, with some of his highlights of his career, some of the people he's faced, some of the people that he tagged with, like Jim Neidhart, the Anvil, and him winning the tag team titles with him, him facing other different wrestlers, and some of the titles he wins, some of the other people who get in his way. And then it kind of near the end, you see that it flashes over to the present, a time when him and Hart are no longer friends. It looks like as we'd call it in wrestling, as they call it in wrestling, he turned heel on Brett, but he comes in and tells him, "Hey, look, I'm not here. I know we're not on the best terms, but I'm here to congratulate you. I told you in the locker room a long time ago that this time would come, and here we are." And then he thanks him, walks out to the ring, and what is he doing? He's fighting Ric Flair for the WWE Championship. And it's cool because you can almost hear the ring announcer saying "fuck," because it ends with the ring announcer. The following contest is for one fall, and it's for the WWE Championship. Obviously, back then, it was the WWF Championship, which, fine, ignore history and go with the WWE because that's what you were supposed to be the whole time. And so I thought that was a strong start just because it has a lot of weight to it, and as far as nostalgia and a character that everybody loved. Especially, you know, with his exit to WCW, it's so famous. When Vince screwed him, the Montreal screw job, as it's called. So that was a cool way to start the anthology. The King of the Bling by Lan Pitts, I love that. Just because you saw the personality of both Ted DiBiase and Razor Ramon. It takes place in a jewelry shop. And I mean, just like the Million Dollar Man would do, he's getting things blinged out, championships and rings and whatnot, and watches and whatever. And then in walks Razor Ramon to pick something up. And I mean, the battle of egos, they could not help each other out. And then just, it starts a fight in the jewelry shop. And although I didn't really care for the art as much, I just didn't like it as much. And I thought that was a great follow-up to the other story, just because of the both of the personalities. You could really see it almost jump off the page, especially with the dialogue that was going back and forth. It was so good. And so I would say that one and the first story are kind of tied for the best ones of the book. The next one, it just really lacked depth, anything. I mean, the art is very basic. It's by Derek Friddles, who does a lot of the books for younger readers and things like that. I especially did not like the colors. Those are by Fred. Stressing, just it's just really mute, really, really underwhelming compared to the other previous two stories, and it kind of really takes you almost out of that mood, just because you're taking these two wrestlers, King Harley Ray and Junkyard Dog, kind of, you know, making them seem less, making them kind of just very, very mute and just not unimportant, and then just really what happens. In this exchange, it's like the last 3 minutes of a match, where you know somebody got screwed and they retaliate, and that's really what the story was. There was nothing to it, and I really didn't like it at all. I was like, okay, so what? The next one, which was Internal Audit. I had to go back and just take a look at who this character was. Mike Rotunda, also known as the guy, the IRS guy who had a briefcase and was, I don't know much about him actually, but this story, I mean, talk about living up to your character. He's an upstanding IRS agent, and some of these thugs kidnap him in order to fix their IRS papers and to make it so that they don't have to pay their taxes. And it's funny, one of the panels says, "My wife and I like to spend our dates nights discussing how I'm going to make sure every tax cheat pays their fair share." So one of those corny gimmicks, just like there always have been in wrestling. You get a good laugh out of it. And then in the end, he makes a deal with who other than the $1 Million Man, Ted DiBiase, which is kind of ironic because, you know, that guy, he does whatever he can to get over, to over and, you know, keep his money to stay rich. And now he's made a deal with this guy who realizes that he's not the most honest guy. And Ted DiBiase talks some things in his ear and convinces him that he's going to, that he pays his fair share and that, they're going to get along and that, you know, that everyone's going to pay their fair share. And then in the end, you see them both with their tag titles and you get a feeling that, Mike kind of sold out. So that was pretty good. It was enjoyable because I got a couple of laughs out of his gimmick more than anything else. So it was pretty good. The last story in the book, The Brain versus the Brawn. I don't know. It was kind of entertaining, but you know, it is what it was. It's pretty much to sum it up really short. Bobby the Brain Heenan, stealing the British Bulldogs, Davy Boy Smith's dog, Matilda, who's famous for being there with him ringside, and stealing him. And then the dog pretty much makes him regret it. Everywhere he goes, he ruins his car. He doesn't let him sleep all night, to the point where Heenan sleeps in the hotel bathtub because the dog won't leave the bed. Then he ruins the hotel and ruins his clothes. So he takes him back and he gives it to him. And that's pretty much it. And so it ends with Heenan crashing into Jake the Snake and his pet snake, him face to face, and then with both the snake and Matilda chasing after Heenan out to the ring, which was kind of funny. It you know, something that maybe you wouldn't necessarily be able to see in the actual ring, just because it's kind of ridiculous with animals, of course. But it was decent. That one was. So as far as ranking all these stories, I would probably have to, I'm going to have to put A Show of Heart at number one, King of the Bling at number two, Internal Audit 3, The Brain versus the Bulldog number four, and then The Royal Treatment at number five. Overall, a decent anthology if you want to get your fix of some classic WWE wrestlers.
Yeah, and I did look it up. Bobby the Brain Heenan died in 2017 from throat cancer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he was 72, but he's definitely a legend when it comes to the world of wrestling, for sure. And a lot of these guys in the anthology were. I was kind of surprised based on the cover. I mean, we didn't get any Rowdy Roddy Piper. We didn't get any Ric Flair. We didn't get any Andre the Giant, yet they were on the cover. So that was kind of interesting. Not that I thought the book was any better or worse because they weren't in it. So yeah, I think you kind of broke it down by story by story, and yeah, that's how every anthology is. There's some good stuff, there's some not good stuff, but overall, like I said, it was enjoyable. But I don't think I'll be picking up any wrestling comics anytime soon. But and that's not a an indictment on wrestling comics. It's just, I don't watch wrestling. It's not my thing. So, you know, why would I pick up wrestling comics? I'm glad I read this one, though, because now I kind of have an idea. And it does make me curious enough to have those questions, too. Like I said, like, are there other comic companies that have wrestling licenses for other, you know, for other wrestling organizations? So
I don't necessarily think that some of the other companies are big enough. And then plus, I know that a lot of the other companies, they really do a better job at letting their wrestlers be a little bit more independent. Mm. So, I mean, I know that WWE is really big on holding on to the licensing to each of the characters. And I know that that's probably why they can do a series of comic books like this, because they own the rights to those characters. Even if they one day decide to split or whatever, like, you know, Macho Man's always going to be mostly their property. And
yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So I think that makes sense. I know that I might be wrong, but I think it's Teenie Howard, who's a big wrestling fan, and she's going to be writing a miniseries for GLOW, which is the Netflix wrestling show about the women. So that's pretty good.
Yeah, and that actually was a wrestling organization right around the time that wrestling, in my mind, had its heyday, when I actually watched it. Yeah, late 80s, early 90s, Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. I remember it used to come on like after Saturday Night Live, like way in the middle of the night, early morning.
Nice.
So I don't know why it was like at that time is when it came on. But yeah, and I haven't seen the show, but I've heard a lot of people say it's really, really good. But again, I'm not a big wrestling fan. So anyway, let's move on to talk about our last book of this episode. It's from Robert Kirkman, as I mentioned earlier. He's the writer, co-creator, along with Lorenzo Di Felici, credited as artist and co-creator. Colors are by Annalisa Leone. Letters are by Russ Wooten. And it's Oblivion Song, which when it launched, they kind of went all out and to really give this a big marketing push. It was kind of billed as the next Walking Dead, which I feel like every time Kirkman comes out with a title, that's what they kind of bill it at. Oh, it's the next Walking Dead. Be sure to, you know, to pick it up or whatever. Well, so here's the thing, right? Robert Kirkman is kind of a household name now. So many people know the name of Kirkman, and The Walking Dead was a comic and blah, blah, blah. First issue is worth like $1,500. And so there's never going to be a next Walking Dead in terms of, you know, here's a comic that came out at the time, 10 years ago. It's been, you know, longer than that now. But here's a comic that hasn't been around that long, that the first issue is worth just tons and tons of money. And it's what everybody wants, right? To catch lightning in a bottle and be able to, you know, buy several issues of, like who among us wouldn't go back and buy, you know, 25 copies or 100 copies or however many copies we could get our hands on of Walking Dead number one, so we could, you know, buy them for cover price and sell them and make tons of money. Everybody would do that if they had the opportunity. And so that's kind of every time Kirkman releases a new number one or a new series, so many people are jumping on it to try to say, hey, maybe this will turn into the next Walking Dead. We see why that doesn't work. The whole reason why Walking Dead is so valuable is because nobody was paying any attention. Kirkman wasn't a household name. Nobody really knew who he was. Here's a black and white comic from Image. Kirkman's the work that he was doing that was being paid attention to as far as the industry went was his work over at Marvel with Marvel Team Up and such. And that, if any of his stuff was selling, it was that stuff, not this black and white independent zombie comic. Because again, zombies weren't even a big thing back then when he released it. The popularity of The Walking Dead kind of reinvigorated the whole zombie genre. And so the reason that book is worth so much money is because, again, there aren't a lot of copies out there because there weren't a lot of copies pre-ordered. There's not going to be another Walking Dead. There's not going to be – I'm sure there's somebody sitting out there on like 25 copies or 100 copies of Oblivion Song that bought into the hype and thinks that they're going to make a ton of money on it. It's not going to happen. It sold a ton of copies, and there are probably still copies available out there at your local comic shop, in the back issue bins, or at shows or whatever. It's easy to find, right? So don't think that we're covering this or we're talking about this because we think it's going to be the next Walking Dead. Again, that was lightning in a bottle. It was a one-time thing. I picked this up more because as much as I don't think that the strength of Robert Kirkman's storytelling is his scripting, don't think he does a great job with dialogue, although I think he's gotten better over the years. You know, he's been doing comics for 20 plus years now, but he's always been a great big idea guy. He always comes up with great big ideas. Like, we just mentioned Thief of Thieves earlier. That is a great idea for a story, great idea for characters, great concepts that he conceptualized and came up with. And then he handed it off to other people, Andy Diggle, Nick Spencer, Brett Lewis, some of the guys, and they really brought that world to life. And it's great. It's a great series. It's one of my favorite Finite series. And again, he didn't write it, but he came up with the big idea. Same thing with Invincible, although Invincible, he wrote most of that. He writes most of The Walking Dead, but he's come up with some other ideas as well, for Skybound, where he doesn't necessarily write it, but he just comes up with the big idea. And then other people are handling the heavy lifting from day to day. Because again, I don't think that's where his strength lies. I think his strength lies in thinking up these cool and crazy ideas. So the idea behind Oblivion Song, which isn't necessarily explained that well in the first issue, is that some kind of event happened where part of the city of Pittsburgh got kind of shifted into another dimension, including all the people that were there at the time. And there was a program funded by the government to go into this. They found out a way to traverse to this dimension and rescue the people that were there. They did it quickly before they could be eaten and killed by the kind of the monsters and the native wildlife of this other dimension. And they've given up now. They rescued what they thought they could rescue, and now they've sort of given up. Well, the one of the retrievers and the head of that program believes that there are still people there that are worth saving, and including his brother, who he never found. And so he's, as issue one starts, he's kind of on a proof of concept mission to go and rescue some people from the other dimension and bring them back to show the government, hey, there's still people alive there. We need to go back, do one final mission, one more thorough mission, and take our time and find everybody that there is to save, you know, kind of a one last rescue mission, you know, clean up as much as we can. So that's kind of what the first issue is about. The title Oblivion Song comes from the fact that this is an alien dimension, and the way that it sounds is different. And so when you're not being chased by a monster, there's not the native wildlife making a bunch of noise, and you just stop to listen to the way that world sounds, that dimension sounds, in terms of the way sound exists for the air currents there, what the insects sound like. It has a separate, distinct sound from the way that our dimension or our world sounds like. And the leader of, or the guy that wants to go and rescue his brother, the former head of this program, he's dubbed that sound the Oblivion Song. And that's where the title of the issue comes from. So I think overall, it's a great start. And this guy, Nathan, is an interesting character. You can kind of understand his motivations. You can kind of understand where he's coming from. But he's a much more complex character than I'm describing here. He's not this, you know, cut and dry, black and white. He's a hero. Always makes the right choices, does the right thing. You can tell right away from the beginning of the story that he's much more real than that. He's much more conflicted and complex, and you know, much more like a fully realized person with this different aspects to his personality. So I read the first issue when it came out. I thought it was really good, and then promptly fell off my radar. And I've been buying it. Like, I literally pre-order it in my DCBS order every month, and the issues come in, and I have only read the first one. And I read the first one like when it first came out. And so when we finally got around, Manny and I were talking about it. We're like, what, you know, we really need to pick something else. We're like, let's pick something a little older for Spotlight Friday. I'm like, hey, what about Oblivion Song? It's something I've always wanted to read. I mean, to the point where I'm buying it every month still. Every month I fill out my order too, and I'm like, I've been trying to cut back on physical comics because I'm literally running out of space. Like, I don't have any more room, but I haven't cut Oblivion Song yet because I feel like, man, I still even haven't even given it a chance. I really need to give it a chance. And so I reread the first issue before we were going to talk about it today. And yeah, it just reminds me that I need to put it on back on my radar. It's really good. I enjoyed the first issue. It's a big chunk of story. It's like 40 pages. So you get a really good start in the first issue. And the artwork, it's not my favorite style of artwork because it's not, I don't know, it's just, I can't quite put my finger on what it is about it that I don't really care for. It's certainly not like photorealistic art. I guess, I don't know, traditional superhero art wouldn't work in this situation either. The monsters are really cartoony looking. Maybe that's what it is. I'm just not sure. I can't quite put my finger on it, but the style of the art isn't my favorite, but it's not to say it's not good art, especially when we're over in the Oblivion Song dimension. There's a lot of interesting things to look at there, but you know, I've only read one issue, so I can't really, I've got to give it more than just one issue before I could maybe put my finger on what about the art I don't care for. Maybe it's just not detailed enough for me. I'm not sure, but it is a great story. Looking forward to getting caught up on it. I'm kind of moving it up the list of my priorities. It's back on my radar. And yeah, I know there's like a podcast out there, a comic book podcast that's like specifically dedicated to just Oblivion Song. It's like an Oblivion Song podcast. That's all they talk about is Oblivion Song. I don't know if there's like enough content. Like they must go like, I don't know, panel by panel. Cause I think there's only like 30 issues out. Maybe not even 30. Maybe they're not even up to 30 yet. I'm not even sure what issue of Oblivion Song. Let me look that up while you give us your thoughts on the issue, Manny.
Man, just last thing I needed was another book to catch up on. I'm already so behind this month thanks to health issues. And now I got to go back and read all these, the rest of these issues for Oblivion Song. Cause it is, I thought it was really, really well done. And I enjoy this type of art just because I think you don't like it because it's super cartoony. And I kind of dig that. It's a little bit different. It's brightly colored, even in some of the couple of pages where they're in the other realm or world, whatever you want to call it. And I mean, just, I think that it's, that the questions that are raised when he's trying to get the funding, and then also just the narrative of his personal, reasons for wanting to go out there. I think was really, really good. Nathan, that's his name.
Yep.
So I'm hooked on it now, especially just the way the first issue ends, and you kind of find out that there's an issue with what he wants and what's probably going to happen. And I thought that was a really, really good, I guess plot device for going forward. And, I want to know more about these people with that seem like they're infected, that are changed. And then also just the repercussions of political policy back home. I think that's really interesting. And then I also found it really, really interesting that the doctor who comes in and talks to him, they start talking about that Oblivion Song. And then like, you can almost tell he's kind of like lulled back into it. And then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, no, heck no, I don't want to go back there. And I thought that was pretty cool. So it gives you an idea that maybe there is some beauty to this other dimension and that you can, behold that these other people who want to live there, can see that maybe they don't want to be rescued. It made for a really, really good first issue. And, now it's time to catch up on the rest.
Yeah. As much as I said, it's not the next, Walking Dead in terms of like value or whatever, when you hear Robert Kirkman, you can't help but think of Walking Dead, and that is a complex story with a big cast. And you just wonder if he's going to be able to at least capture the same sort of magic with the characters here in this story. So, you know, one can hope. I actually am like way behind on Walking Dead. I think the last issue I read was like in the lower 80s, because that's a story that I have to read in big giant chunks, because read one issue, I feel like there's not enough story there. So I always want to read it in big giant chunks. And it's another one that I just haven't gone back to in a really long time. So, but yeah, I do want to get caught up on this. I looked it up. So March, this month, they're up to issue 13. So I forgot that it's only been out for a year. It just seems like it's been so much longer and I'm so much further behind. But yeah, March 2018 was when the first issue came out. So I'm not that far behind. But I think part of the reason I feel like it's been out a lot longer is there was like a super advanced preview that comic shops were able to get and a lot of press got in like October of 2017. So that's sort of when it was on. I mean, I heard about it before then, but I think that was when I got my preview copy and read the first issue in 2017, of October of 2017. So I feel like that's why, in a way, it feels like it's been around for so much longer and I'm further behind. But yeah, it's only a year. It's only been out for a year, so it shouldn't be that hard to get caught up. But the other thing that makes me think of is, remember I mentioned that Oblivion Song podcast? Is there really enough content to be... I mean, maybe the podcast comes out only once a month when the issue drops. They just talk about the issue. Like, I have no idea. I just remember seeing the podcast and thinking, Oblivion Song. I could see how you could do like an Invincible podcast because there's, you know, 165 issues, 170 issues to talk about. That's a lot of content to cover. But when you're talking, there's literally been 12 issues of that have come out so far. It's like, how many episodes of a podcast can you get out from just that limited amount? But anyway, I'm sure the Oblivion podcast is a great podcast and worthy of your time. So go and check it out. I don't know. It'd be funny if one of them hears that we were talking about it and reaches out. So anyway, I think that's going to do it for this Spotlight Friday. Anything to say about any of these issues, Manny?
Nope, not really. Just can't wait to see what Justice League has in store for us.
Yeah, I agree. Of all the stuff that we talked about today, I feel like Justice League is the must read that's coming out from DC. Scott Snyder, James Tynion doing an incredible job. And again, the artwork in that issue from Daniel Sampier and Adriana Lucas, and we should probably mention that the inks from Juan Alberon, you know, really help add texture and some cleanliness to the lines of Daniel Sampier. We didn't mention him before except the initial credits. But yeah, the entire art team, Sampier, Alberon, Lucas, absolutely incredible job. And we'll throw a shout out to Tom Napolitano as well. I did mention that there was a pretty dialogue heavy issue of Justice League. And it's not always easy when there's a lot of dialogue to find real estate to put in all these words that we need to read without negatively impacting the art. And Tom did a great job of that on this particular issue. So that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. The Comic Source is a member of the LRM Podcast Network, so when you visit the site, be sure to check out some of our other podcasts like Los Fanboys, our official movie and TV podcast hosted by Joseph Jammer Medina, Netflix and Chill, hosted by Nick and Carrie, covering a wide variety of film and television topics with Game of Thrones and Star Wars as particular favorites. And finally, Mike and Mark's Marvelous Adventures, as these two former athletes share their love of sports and geek culture by chatting about anything and everything sports and geek related. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.